How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez and Dave Meltzer here on Wrestling Observer Radio. It is October 15, 2013, here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. Obviously, we have to talk about Raw here tonight. There are new tag team champions. Goldust and Cody Rhodes beat The Shield in the main event of Raw to win the tag team titles. And apparently, a lot of last-minute switching going on backstage before the show in terms of matches. This match obviously was going to take place at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. Still will, but title change was moved up.
Well, it's now a three-way.
Three-way. It'll be Shield, Rhodes, and apparently the Usos.
Yeah.
For the tag team titles.
Yeah, that's the Hell in a Cell match, so.
And they have added, after last week, Vince said that there would not be two Hell in a Cell matches on a single pay-per-view because it was overkill. Well, changed his mind. Now we have two, and the other one is Paul Heyman and the Ryback against CM Punk in a two-on-one Hell in a Cell match.
Yeah, and this was not like adding a new layer to the previous planned stipulation. I mean, Punk and Ryback as a single match rematch was the plan until this afternoon, and this afternoon Vince made the change, and I don't know. There was a lot of stuff that happened today, and I don't really know all of it. But that much I know, those two matches on the pay-per-view were changed. The tag title change was actually going to be on the pay-per-view originally. It got moved up to this TV. And as far as, other changes, I don't know what they are. I don't know what the status is of, AJ and who she's going to work with. She was cleared this afternoon.
Sure seemed to be Brie Bella.
What?
Sure seemed to be Brie Bella.
Yeah, it's what it seemed to be, but, she beat her already, so.
Yeah, but the way they set up this angle, that means nothing if you beat somebody already. I mean, we've seen a million matches where champion beats the challenger, and then that leads to a title match.
Yeah.
Let's look at this show here.
Okay.
We'll get into it as we go through it. Open up with Sean coming down to the ring. And basically gave the same speech that he gave last week about why we should vote for him to be the special referee.
We already voted for him.
In the Daniel Bryan. Well, that's right, but he gave the same speech he gave last week.
Yeah.
So he talked about how he trained Daniel Bryan. He was friends with Triple H, but he was still going to call it down the middle. Doesn't like Randy Orton.
He doesn't like Randy Orton, yeah.
Said the battleground finish was, and I quote, a crock. And he guaranteed that it would not happen again. He guaranteed we would have a new champion at the pay-per-view. They are trying very hard to convince us that, seriously this time, you're really going to get a champion, which I do expect.
They've got to put it on Bryan. It's like they have to do it on this show. I don't know if they will. I mean, I presume they will. The thing is I'd also thought that the finish was going to be, the Big Show knocking out Randy Orton, and that's how Bryan was going to win the championship. Even though it's a Hell in a Cell, but stuff happens in Hell in a Cell. I'm glad, in a sense, that they did that finish tonight, so they can't, I shouldn't say they can't do it on the pay-per-view, but they shouldn't do it on the pay-per-view now. And I would rather that Bryan won, convincingly and got a real run as champion. With Cena back, who's to say what's going to happen? We'll see.
Soren came down to the ring, and he said that Sean resented him because Sean, as great as he was never as good as Randy Orton.
Yeah, and the thing, he had to turn heel on the city because they were in St. Louis. It's his hometown, sure. And he was cheered more than Sean. So he had to say that all the fans in St. Louis were stupid, which really didn't matter because they still cheered him anyway later in the show.
So Sean says, you don't got to worry about me. He should be worrying about Daniel Bryan. Orton said he would destroy Daniel Bryan. He said if Sean screwed him over, he would destroy him. Sean said he was not intimidated. So they did a spot where Orton went for the RKO. Sean slipped out. Sean went for the super kick. Orton slipped out. And as he rolls out of the ring to bail, who should blindside him but The Miz? Because that was the first match here on the show. And off we go. Quick opening segment for once.
Orton made a point of saying how Sean is not a stranger to screw jobs and things like that.
Yes. So we had Orton versus Miz. More competitive than a lot of the matches they've had in the past. Orton just completely destroyed him. Miz made a big comeback. And suddenly, the Wyatt music hit. Lights go out. When they come back on, Bray Wyatt is already in the chair on the ramp. So that's how they got around him having a calf injury. So Miz is distracted like a numbskull. Turns around, gets hit by the RKO. 1, 2, 3. At which point, Wyatt cut a promo on him, burying him for his obsession with fame. And he promised to put him down. So this match is still scheduled. We'll see how Wyatt's calf heals.
It might be some sort of a tag match with the Wyatt family against Miz and Kofi or somebody like that. As of right now, Bray will not be on the pay-per-view wrestling, but it's not, like a week from now, that may change depending on how quickly he recovers. I mean, the word was 4 weeks out, but he may, let's see, what are we, 14? It's pushing it close.
Well, maybe he'll go start training with John Cena.
Starts doing what John Cena does, he'll be ready tomorrow.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Something to think about.
Yeah.
We had Fandango and Santino. Quick match. Santino went for the Cobra, but Summer jumped up on the apron and he almost hit her. And then, yes, Santino was distracted and Fandango rolled him up for the pin. So two distraction finishes in a row here on Raw.
Yeah, this was a total comedy match. Nothing, you know, 2 minutes of whatever. 2 minutes of Santino. What it always is.
We had Brad Maddox, backstage with Paul Heyman. And Paul was showing him video of Punk doing the low blow. Since, if you recall, he tried to show video last week and his video didn't work. So he got it to play this week and he noted that Punk was a cheater. He demanded Maddox do something. Maddox was like, what do you want me to do? So Paul says, well, I would like to pick the stipulation for Hell in a Cell. I want it to be a three-way. Punk versus Ryback versus Axel. Brad said, well, that's unfair. He said, listen, I'll make you a deal. We'll do Beat the Clock tonight with Ryback versus Truth.
He wanted a two-on-one handicap match with Punk against Ryback and Axel.
Yes. Brad said this was unfair. So
yes.
Brad offered Beat the Clock, Ryback versus Truth, and Punk versus Axel. And he said if Ryback beat the clock, Paul would get to choose the stipulations. And if Punk won, Punk would get to choose these stipulations. Paul was not thrilled with this, but he accepted it. So that was the Beat the Clock challenge for later. Cut back to the announcers, and they had JBL talking about how Xavier Woods is doing a Twitter campaign to get Big Show his job back. And boy, did JBL go off on Xavier Woods.
Well, he only went off on the name.
Repeatedly.
Yeah,
on and on.
You know what's funny is like he acted like he didn't know who Xavier Woods was, and then Cole brought up that you're the acting general manager of NXT, where Xavier Woods wrestles. So it was kind of a weird, awkward. I mean, I'm surprised that Cole brought that up since NXT's never really acknowledged on the major show, and it just kind of, you know.
Well, it was clearly meant to be comedy.
Yeah, well, kind of. I don't know. It was showed him up in a way that. You know, I don't think he was ready for because he had no comeback. I guess this is a way to... They've been wanting to introduce Xavier Woods on TV just because... You know, I watch him in NXT. I mean, he's fine, but he doesn't stand out to me at all. But they've been wanting to introduce him because, you know, he's got the master's degree and working on his doctorate and all that stuff. And the feeling is that he's a great... representative, you know, the kind of a guy that they can put in forth in public and things like that. So they kind of want to get him up and going. And I guess this is the deal. And they put it on the website. And then during the show, they actually took it off the website with the idea that Triple H had, in fact, banned that from the website. So that was kind of an interesting thing. But, you know, I guess this is the way they introduce Xavier Woods. It's kind of we'll see. I mean, it just seems like he's going to go in there and he's going to be some guy that. Whoever, you know, Big Show is wrestling is going to take out and just be a whipping boy, which is not the best way to get a guy going, but there you go.
Cena video. He is a hero. He is a man you should cheer and respect. That's what I got out of it.
Well, they've been doing that for 5 years.
5 years?
Well, I mean, as far as like really pushing the idea that you need to cheer him. I mean, before that, people actually did cheer him.
We had Drew McIntyre and Heath Slater against the Matadors. In a feud which will, at this point, never end. Actually, it will end because they've already planned
Matadors are going against Swagger and Cesaro.
That's right.
Quick.
Set them up against the Americans. Anyway, the most noteworthy thing in this match is that the Bull has his own Twitter account.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. Oh. And JBL apparently, I think JBL said he followed him.
Oh, okay.
So there you go. Matadors won. They are getting some Ole chants. The Bull embarrassed Jinder afterwards. And JBL just went on and on and on about Torito. Big fan.
Good. They did their double torture rack deal on Jinder after the match, and Torito did a springboard sitting splash onto him. So I guess that's going to be what they're going to do for the post-match, on TV matches for a while to get Torito over.
You know, the thing about that sit-down splash, if you recall, Damian Sandow can no longer do cartwheels because of the fact that they are being done in NXT. And in fact, on NXT this week, we had Mojo Rawley debut, and he also did a sitting splash. So
yeah, but it was a different kind of... I mean, it was the same move, but it's one... You know, Mojo Rawley did this high jumping...
He did an earthquake splash.
Yeah, like the earthquake, yeah, but jumping much higher. And then this guy's doing it as a springboard move, so I don't know that they're going to make him cut it out because Mojo Rawley's doing it in NXT.
Or the other way around.
Yeah, you're right. It could be the other. I don't think they will. I mean, worry about it. Who knows? I kind of thought the Mojo Rawley as a finisher, I didn't really think it was really the right finisher for him, but
it's not the kind of finisher you expect to see out of a football player.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he should be doing something, more like a flying tackle or something like that.
Or a big kick.
What?
How about a field goal kick?
They kind of banned that.
Yeah. We had Hunter and Steph. Hunter came to the ring, and he has fake lat syndrome in his suit, which I think is awesome. So fans are chanting, "You got knocked out." The announcer selling Big Show's house, Stephanie, obviously, not the fans, and that they are suing him for trespassing and assault. Crowd was into this, by the way.
Yeah, and they're going to repossess everything that he owns.
That's
well,
right.
Yeah, they're definitely into Hunter and Stephanie, sure.
Says Hunter so said the... Actually, Triple H just kind of stood there, and Stephanie announced the reports of him suffering a concussion were inaccurate. This is Triple H, she explained. He never sells, which he confirmed, by the way. Said... he had suffered for us ever since he took over as head of this company, but the knockout was his breaking point. He was infuriated with the people chanting yes over his fallen body. He said, "You guys want me to be the bad guy? Fine, I'll be the bad guy." Said Show was going to grovel at his feet, as would anybody in the back who crossed him. Daniel Bryan came out on the ramp. Apparently he was just there to do a bunch of yes chants. Del Rio jumped him from behind. Gave him a super kick to the face, and then Stephanie signed the match for tonight, at which point Hunter began doing yes chants, which was great.
Yeah, everyone. Big Show did them at the end of the show, too.
A lot of yes chants here on this show.
Yeah, kind of, I don't know. Yeah, I just remember...
Diego Sanchez needs some royalty checks or something out of this deal.
Yeah, I know. He was the one who came up with it, but I sense when Big Show was doing those yes chants, it just hit me like when... you know how Sabu introduced the tables? And then when everyone in ECW started doing the tables, Sabu was just like furious because he knew that it was going to be the beginning of the end to him. I don't know if Brian knows it.
I'm pretty sure Daniel Bryan can get something else over.
Yeah, of course, but it's still kind of taking away the thing that, you know, he brought in and, you know, making it not kind of not his as much anymore.
I'm not too worried about him.
Yeah, I'm not worried about him. I'm just making the point that if it was somebody else, and it was...
If it was Hunter's chant, no one else would be doing it?
No, I mean, Hunter, John Cena, anyone, you know, anyone that they that was their guy, and, you know, they would, you know, there'd be exclusivity. You know, they couldn't do their move, they couldn't do their chant, nothing like that. I mean, did you see, doing, like, you know, Rock stuff when Rock was there?
Mick Foley.
Not in the same way, and he was only doing his weird comedy.
So we had a Ryback and Truth in a beat the clock match. Truth was running outside. Ryback's chasing him, trying to catch him. And JBL calmly notes that Ryback should just wait in the ring and win via countout. Apparently, Ryback didn't think of this. Lawler.
He would have won right away.
Yeah. Lawler, and this was no coincidence, noted, I love it when the fans chant Goldberg.
Yeah, well, he was fed that line, you could tell.
You could tell
by the way he delivered it. So, I mean, that's Vince. That's what you need to know. I mean, they're definitely gunning for that match.
Plug the DVD as well, which just came out.
Yeah, the one thing, it was kind of weird. And Ryback wasn't the only one. Del Rio as well. It's kind of weird to watch heels with this Rise Above Cancer shirt being heels at the same time. Just kind of weird.
Yeah. What I thought was more weird was that this was a beat the clock match, and when Ryback had the heat for like 4 minutes, he worked with absolutely no urgency at all, which you would think would be the main way you would work a match where you were trying to beat the clock. So Truth made a comeback and then got shell-shocked. 5 minutes, 44 seconds. Paul was not too happy, but thought it was a decent time.
Yeah.
Steph and the Bellas backstage. Steph congratulated Brie on her engagement and then said, you do realize that your boyfriend was doing yes chants over the fallen body of my husband last week. And then she signed Brie and Tamina. No Nikki allowed at ringside, but AJ was going to be there to watch. And Brie was very sad.
Yeah, they had like Stephanie like hug her, and she gave this look like she was repulsed by her.
Yes.
Yeah. So
yeah, the Real Americans against Tons of Funk. Zeb threatened the Matadores and the Bull, so they're going to be feuding, obviously. Tensai delivered a monkey flip on Cesaro, which was awesome. Cesaro did a gut wrench deadlift on Tensai, which was awesome. Brodus busted out a perfect plex, which I did not expect. Actually got a lot more time than you'd think. And then finally, Cesaro.
Much more time than you. There's only 5 minutes, five and a half minutes.
I did not expect this match to get 3.5 minutes.
Okay.
Got 5.5. Neutralizer on Brodus, which is pretty impressive. And afterwards, he went to give the giant swing to Brodus, but Brodus apparently wanted no part of this. So instead, he grabbed Tensai, managed 5 revolutions.
I counted 3.
I may have given him more credit.
Yeah, it was not a good one in the sense that, they want him to do, 10.
Yeah, it didn't quite work out here.
Yeah, it was the first time it didn't quite, Tensai's a big dude.
He is a big, weird-shaped fella.
I think that Brodus probably weighs similar to Tensai. I don't know who would weigh more. They're both probably in the well over 330.
Well, he got Great Khali around, so it's not impossible. It just didn't quite work out this time.
It's different weight distribution, though. I mean, Khali is probably legitimately about 360.
I would think Khali would be significantly more difficult based on his length.
Okay. I was wondering if the length helps or hurts. I don't know because Tensai's so thick.
I don't know. We need someone who builds airplanes. Maybe can help.
He did it twice with Khali with no problem, and with Tensai he was.
Well, the first time he tried on Khali, he needed 2 tries to get it going.
Yeah, well, this one he had a lot of trouble getting him up, and when he did, he dropped him pretty quick. Not that it's any big deal. I mean, it's still pretty damn impressive. But it wasn't the big reaction like usual because people were kind of flat on, they were expecting this, the same deal he did with Khali.
We had Brie and Tamina. AJ was out there. No heat early. They're doing a deal now where AJ talks to the belt because, of course, he's crazy, which led actually to AJ's crazy chance. So Brie makes a comeback. Tamina kicked her to death, got the pin, killed her with a Samoan drop. Gave her a shoulder breaker, gave her a big splash. Problem with Brie is, as we've noted, she's lost a lot of weight, very skinny, and unfortunately, no padding when you're that skinny. And she's just looked like she's taken a great deal of punishment here in these matches. And then AJ put her in the Black Widow and torqued her all up, looked like she nearly killed her. I think Brie, you could actually hear her saying, stop, right before they broke it up. I don't think this felt too good. They really put a beating on Brie. And this led to Brian being very upset with Stephanie. And she, by the way, was watching the Goldberg versus Triple H match from the DVD, which I thought was hilarious. And Steph told him to calm down. Maybe you should go tend to your fiance. And he stormed off. So that was a segment. Punk and Axel beat the clock. With about a minute left, Paul was screaming for Axel to just hold him down. But Axel was not listening, kept doing moves. And then he got hit with the GTS with 11 seconds left. Paul was livid. This meant that Punk got to choose the stipulation. He said that Paul was a crazy genius, and he had learned a lot from him, and he liked Paul's idea of a three-way, and therefore it was going to be Punk versus Ryback and Paul Heyman in a three-way inside the Hell in a Cell.
Handicap match, not a three-way.
A handicap match. Well, same thing. It's three guys. Obviously, it's two-on-one. So the place went crazy with CM Punk chants, and they were into this. They were into this. So we'll see if Paul gets his. Although it is two-on-one in a cage. So
he's got to take something, though.
Yeah?
I don't know how much. In theory, this could be the one that Ryback wins. But
better be.
Yeah, or else they got to go in another direction, right? And there's no other direction to go in just yet.
We had Brian versus Alberto. Non-title match. Very hard-hitting. Both guys bleeding from the mouth by the time this thing was over. Couple of weird spots, maybe a little bit of miscommunication, but overall pretty good. Brian makes his big comeback, and suddenly Orton appears on the big screen. He says he is going into the Bella's locker room to check on Brie.
Trainer's room.
Well, trainer's room. Going to check on Brie. Shuts the door. You hear screams. So Del Rio tries to cradle Brian for yet another interference distraction finish, but Brian kicks out, and then he hits a big kick, runs backstage, gets counted out of the ring. He runs into the trainer's room. There's no Randy Orton there. The girls are just standing around, and then Randy rushes in, blindsides him, throws him into the side of a conveniently placed metal thing, and lays him out.
One of those rehab tubs.
Girls cry, and there you go. Brian laid out. This Orton Brie thing.
What?
This Orton Brie Bella thing.
Yeah, what about it?
Daniel Bryan knows not to let them do a storyline where Orton and Brie Bella get together.
I hope so.
Hope so.
Hope so. The odds aren't good if he does, right?
No, they're not.
No, they're not, yeah.
We had
I mean, there have been people who buck the odds. I mean, I can't really come up with anyone off the top of my head.
I'm sure they're out there.
Yeah. I just remember, like, when the big joke was how Steve and Deborah McMichael, their marriage survived, you know, what was it, like 18 years, 17 years of the NFL, and they did one angle with where they split up, and she went with Jeff Jarrett, and their marriage was over.
Yeah, not good. So we had Stephanie meeting with the Shield, Stephen Hunter, actually, and Steph noted that the Rhodes had beaten them before, so they better be on their game. Hunter said it was no DQ tonight and then commanded them to finish it. And so when they left, him and Steph proceeded to make out, which repulsed the crowd. Great heel spot. So we had another Cena video, and this one was a bunch of short videos that he had put together, touts, I'm sure, of him updating us on his rehab progress. And sure enough, there he was. A month or so later, arm taped up, doing heavy Olympic lifting. So it's no joke. Guy's back training, and he is ready to go. Don't ask me how. But it's right there on video. Saw it with my own eyes. So then we had the Shields and the Rhodes family. Old school tag team match early. They got the heat on Cody. He got a hot tag. Actually, he missed, which is always funny, because then you have to scramble to get it again. Goldust made his comeback. He got cut off. Goldust selling. He does an excellent job. Crowd really started to get into it. He's selling. And he makes a hot tag to Cody. Cody makes a big comeback. Crowd's into the match, but they're still not really buying the near falls at this point. Breaks down into a four-way. Dean Ambrose hits the ring. No DQ. Breaks up a crossroads. So now it's 3-on-2. They set up the triple power bomb. Goldust runs in with a chair. Breaks it up. Start brawling all over everywhere, ringside, outside the ring. Seth picks up Cody, power bombs him into the dasher boards. Looks like he nearly killed him.
Oh, that was brutal.
Oh, yeah. Right in the shoulder and head.
Ooh.
Goldust clears the ring. Dean Ambrose runs in yet again. Crowd's chanting, "This is awesome." Roman Reigns spears Goldust through the dasher boards. Bunch of holy shit chants. And then suddenly, through the crowd comes the Big Show. Crowd goes crazy. He proceeds to knock out the Shield one by one, finally knocking out Roman Reigns. Cody is there in the ring, climbs on top, 1, 2, 3. Place goes nuts. New tag team champions. Everybody's celebrating. Show leaves through the crowd. As you noted, he's leading the crowd in the yes chant. It was actually, everything about this was awesome, and I hate to even say anything negative about it, but I'm going to. The only thing that drove me absolutely crazy is they did this match. They have this great story, which was that Big Show is repaying the Rhodes family for knocking out Dusty. They get their revenge on the Shield. They win the tag team titles, ending the Shield's tag team title reign. And as they're in the ring and the crowd is going crazy, Hunter Hearst Helmsley runs down to the ring in a suit, and he proceeds to shove Cody Rhodes and Goldust out of the ring like two geeks so he can pitch his fit. And I was so infuriated when I saw that. And they just fell out of the ring and went off on their way like geeks and got on the ramp and celebrated. But I was just like, man, you really had to steal the heat from these guys just because this is your storyline with the Big Show. I mean,
well, here's the thing.
It's one thing to run in and pitch a fit as they're, you know, if they would have left first.
That's the thing. There's ways you could do that without doing it. They could have just grabbed the belts,
gone up to the ramp,
celebrated, and then jumped into the crowd. Although Big Show was doing that, so maybe they didn't want to.
They could have all been in the crowd.
Yeah, they could have all been in. Well, they probably only wanted the Big Show solo.
Or they could have been on the ramp, and Hunter just storms on past them.
Yep. Absolutely.
Anything.
They could have just left the ring. And he could have come out. Yeah, you're right.
He just got in the ring, and you just got to watch it. He gets in the ring, and they're on their feet, and he shoves them into the ropes and onto their ass. And then they roll out of the ring. It's like, you got to be kidding me, you idiot. Well, so that infuriated me.
He needed to get his heat back after last week.
Sure, yeah. Great. So other than that, I thought this was very well done. Excellent. And we'll see what happens at Hell in a Cell, if the Shield gets the belts back or what they do here. But crowd certainly into the Rhodes clan at this point.
Well, I thought they were into it because the match was really great. Because they weren't, you know, the one thing I was noticing is like the first 10 minutes of the match, they weren't really into it at all.
No, but they got them into it.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they're, you know, because I was really disappointed how not over the storyline was to this crowd in St. Louis. But I mean, the match got over because of the work. The work was awesome. But the idea that, you know, I mean, for a main event match, the first 10 minutes, it was really flat. So, you know, that told me that this crowd was not that into this storyline. You know, I mean, they were by the end, but that's a different deal.
Well, we'll see what they do. We got new tag team champions for God knows how long it's been since the Shield had the titles. I'll actually find out here. I'll get the stats. But it's the first title change on Raw of any major importance in a long, long time. And one thing this isn't really a complaint or anything like that. I guess Shield had him since May, so 148 days after being Team Hell No. So it wasn't really that long. But one thing I was thinking, though, this isn't really a complaint. It kind of is because it affected my pocketbook when I paid $54.95 for Battleground and got jack shit. They gave this tag title change away for free on Raw. And I just watched it through consumer eyes and thought, man, why the hell would I buy pay-per-views? I get the best stuff on Raw. Last two pay-per-views have sucked.
No, but here's the thing. You say that all the time, which is true. And then some people go, well, you know, the pay-per-views aren't a priority. However, John Cena's debut, they are not putting John Cena on television to do any promos for Alberto Del Rio, because they're going to debut him on the pay-per-view because they think that, you know, it's not worth giving away his return on television and compromise the pay-per-view. So it's like they go back and forth. It's not like a steady, consistent well, we don't care about pay-per-views, because they do. But, you know, like this situation, I mean, this situation...
Well, hopefully they get some buy rates in and they start to care about pay-per-views more.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, but, you know, you would think that the last two pay-per-views, when they you know, saved all the good stuff for Raw, that, you know what I mean? That they're training the audience not to watch the pay-per-views. I mean, there's no way around it. You know, they're telling you, like, look, you know, you can be a geek and spend $55 and buy the pay-per-views. You know, you can, but, you know, you're an idiot to do so. And pretty soon, you know, people start, you know, not wanting to do so much. There you go. I mean, at least from the last two, but yeah, like this, like I said, like this tag team title change was scheduled for the next pay-per-view. I don't know what they're, you know, I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know if they're going to go back to the Shield. I don't know if they're going to, you know, the program though is a long-term program. It's not going to end on the pay-per-view. They're still going to be married to each other for, I don't know how long, but it's, you know, November and then plus December and everything. And then after that, I don't know. I think maybe then, you know, probably leads to a Rhodes family split, and then they go their separate ways.
The New Japan pay-per-view, you have seen it. Second half, apparently very good, and another excellent main event.
Yeah, the first half of the show was just so-so, but what a fantastic main event. I mean, it was, I don't know how to, like, rate these Tanahashi Okada matches, like, which is better, because they're all different. And this was awesome. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, it was a match of the year candidate. It was, you know, I don't know if it was the best match of the year, but it's on the list. And I mean, and that wasn't the only good one. I mean, Shibata and Katsuyori Shibata and Tomohiro Ishii. I mean, it wasn't close to the last one. It couldn't be, but it was pretty damn great. And then Shinsuke Nakamura and Naomichi Marufuji was pretty great. Okada retained the championship, so it looks like Okada and Naito. The angle after was tremendous. Okada had won the title. He was giving his big thing, and then Prince Devitt comes out. And so, you know,
Okada won the title?
What? Okada retained.
Retained.
Yeah. So Prince Devitt came out. So, it's going to be Okada and Prince Devitt on the next pay-per-view. And he's mouthing off to Okada. And then from behind, Carl Anderson just destroys Okada. I mean, it was a brutal, you know, I mean, you know, just beat him up and gave him a gun stun on the championship belt and cut a promo on him and, you know, basically said that he's been waiting since the finals of last year's G1 in August of 2012 to get back at Okada, even though they've actually wrestled each other many times since then. But, you know, he's been waiting. Well, he lost all those matches, so he's been waiting. He said he was so close to it being his night, you know, of breaking through and winning the G1 last year, and Okada took it from him, and he's taken the belt from Okada. This is going to be November 9th in Osaka, which is the next their next pay per view. Their next eye pay per view is actually October 25th, but their next pay per view. But I mean, overall, you know, Super Show, their shows go so freaking long. I mean, this is a 4-hour and 45-minute show. And actually, it was longer than that, because it's 4 hours and 45 minutes was when I went to bed at, you know, 4:45 a.m. or 4:30 a.m. And they were the show was still going on. They were still doing backstage interviews, you know, and I had tapped out by then. But I will say this. I mean, that main event was started 4 in the morning my time. I was not the slightest bit tired, and I did not doze off or anything during this entire show. And I didn't even take a nap during the day, which was my kind of like my goal was I'm going to sleep for a couple hours so I stay up all night. You know, I think I may have gotten tired in the about 1:30 a.m. during some of the prelims, but once those good matches started going, man, it was just great. Show opens. It's Manabu Nakanishi, super strong machine who barely even got in the ring. He's like 57 years old, I think. Jushin Liger, Tiger Mask against Takashi Iizuka, Yoshihashi, Ghetto, and Jado. This match really wasn't any good. You know, it was below the normal level of your opening match. Tiger Mask didn't really do much, and he usually does a little bit more. Liger you know, didn't do a lot. He did a little bit. Nakanishi can't do anything. Machine barely got in. Iizuka went after, you know, TV announcer Shimpei Nogami. Exactly the same as always, other than he did not tear his dress shirt off, which is new. But he dragged him by his shirt from the desk over the guardrail, which was actually pretty good visual. And then he spray painted him with this white spray paint. He sprayed. The new thing now is instead of tearing off, well, he's been tearing off the shirt a lot, but he now spray paints his face with a different color spray paint every time. So that was that. But meh. And then Takami Chinoku and Taichi won the IWGP Junior Tag Team titles from Rocky Romero and Alex Kozlov. This, of course, was the match. Well, it was supposed to be Alex Shelley and Kushida who were going to win the belts, but Shelley got hurt. This was also a disappointing match. Short. Taichi is like this guy. I think he's got like great natural charisma, but he just doesn't do anything in the ring. And Taka's old, and you know it was Taka did an eye poke on Rocky Romero, and then Taichi used a low blow on Rocky Romero and pinned him. But just not, you know, it wasn't like it was a bad match. It was an average match. Then Minoru Suzuki and Toru Yano. Now this was a bad match. Just nothing. But it was, you know, storyline taken from like last month's match. You know, the whole match was built around the handcuffs again. You know, because last month they had that great, not even last month, it was only 2 weeks ago, September 29th. They had that great finish with the handcuff spot where Suzuki was handcuffed to the guardrail and got counted out. So this time, Yano brings out the handcuffs again, tries to handcuff Suzuki to the guardrail. Suzuki thwarts him from doing so and handcuffs Yano to the guardrail and jumps in the ring to wait for Yano to lose by countout. But Yano went to his knee pad and he had the key and unlocked the handcuffs from the guardrail and jumped into the ring at 19 or 17 actually. Then they started fighting again and Suzuki handcuffed both of Yano's wrists into the handcuffs. So he was helpless. And, Suzuki, you know, just beat the hell out of him, essentially. Slapped him around, drop-kicked him in the face, and gave him this long-delayed Carl Gotch pile driver and pinned him. But really, as entertaining as that may sound, it was, you know, the only good stuff was Suzuki's facial expressions, including one spot where Yano came out and threw water all over Suzuki, and Suzuki just had this look on his face like, I am going to kill you. I mean, he was good there, but nothing match. And Lance Archer and Davey Boy Smith Jr., NWA World Tag Team Champions against Hiroyoshi Tenzan and Takaaki Watanabe. Satoshi Kojima was at ringside. Kojima is hurting bad. Obviously, he didn't even wrestle. He got his shoulder dislocated. But, you know, the shoulder dislocation did come in the final spot, but he worked that match with Okada at the last pay-per-view, you know, for like 25 minutes, and he's really beaten up. And he was another casualty of the G1. He was hurting worse and worse, but got his way through it. And then since he, you know, beat Okada in the G1, he had to come back with a pay-per-view match. But, yeah, his body just, you know, again, gave out. Tenzan, it's his first match back, and, you know, God bless him. He wasn't ready to be back. And there really wasn't much they could do with him. Watanabe, you know, this is his last match in Japan. He got a little, you know, a little bit of fiery stuff here and there. The match was all right. I mean, better than average, but, you know, I mean, not as good as most of the Archer and Smith matches usually are on these shows. Then from this point on, the show got really good. Everything was great from here. We had Tomoaki Hanma, Togi Makabe, and Kota Ibushi against Prince Devitt, Carl Anderson, and Bad Luck Fale, which ended with Carl Anderson pinning Honma after two gun stuns. Fale and Makabe went at it after the match, so it looks like they're going to break them off into some sort of a singles deal. And obviously, Devitt and Ibushi, I think it's a lock that they're going to be doing something over the Junior Heavyweight Championship, or at least they should be, because the Junior Heavyweight Championship's been dead for, you know, a long time. I mean, Devitt hasn't really had any good challengers, I think partially because Taguchi's been hurt. This was a very good match, fun match, you know, all the way through. Then we had Ishii and Shibata, and they just killed each other. Shibata finally won with the penalty kick, but this match was awesome. I mean, again, it was not as good as their match in Osaka in August. It would have been possible to be that good. And I was almost like, God, it's like, you know, when they did the, Goto and Ishii, after they had that unbelievable match, and they came back the next month. And I was like, God, it's too soon. You got the memory of this great match. You shouldn't come back so quick. And I was thinking, as soon as this match started, I was thinking the same thing, but it was still just a really fun match. Then they had some guests, and they were promoting there's a new Tiger Mask movie. They showed the trailer on the big screen, and they had one of the stars of the movie, there, and the Tiger Mask was there, and the actor who's playing the Tiger Mask in the movie was in costume there as well, so they did that. Then we had the Gracie family promo. Daniel and Hollis Gracie came out, and they looked like they were strange men in a different world. Talking about they would be wrestling on January 4th at the Tokyo Dome and challenged anybody from New Japan Pro Wrestling. And then they sat at ringside as Sakuraba wrestled, because you're Sakuraba against Yuji Nagata. The Sakuraba-Nagata match, if you liked the last one, then you'd like this one. If you didn't like the last one, then you wouldn't like this one. I liked the last one, liked this one. So, good match. Sakuraba was going for a lot of submissions, and Nagata kept getting out. Sakuraba had him in a choke, and Nagata, from that position, got behind him and gave him a bridging back suplex and got the pin. And then after the match, Nagata started cutting a promo on the Gracies, and Sakuraba then said that, in fact, he has a history with the Gracies.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and he wanted to be his partner, and they did a pinky shake. So it will be Sakuraba. The first match for the Tokyo Dome official is Sakuraba and Nagata against the... Are Daniel and Hollis Gracie brothers? Because they call them the Gracie brothers.
I'm not actually sure.
Okay. They called them brothers. But it's just like, you know, when I saw it, in the crowd, when the Gracies came out, I mean, it wasn't that big of a deal. They didn't, like, violently negatively react, like, oh, God, not the shooters again. Because, you know, those fans there, I mean, the shooter thing, it's like one of those, you know, angles that it works, but then you got to stop it. You know, you do it until you burn it out, and then you can't do it again for, like, years. Or you do it in very limited amounts every now and then on a big show. But New Japan just went hog wild for it for a couple of years, and pretty much...
They're not brothers.
They're not? Okay.
Not brothers.
They called them brothers. But anyway, they... New Japan, like, you know, pretty much killed the... they killed the company with it. And so a lot of fans, some of the older fans, kind of have nightmares whenever you bring an MMA guy in that's not, you know, not an MMA guy like a Don Fry or something that, you know, or Josh Barnett or someone who actually can do this, but you know, these guys who clearly have no business, you know, they're just not pro wrestlers, and they made that point that they're not pro wrestlers and they're trying to do the thing, and Nagata did do the old, you know, the old gimmick, which is how they used to do it in the in the 80s, you know, where New Japan is the king of sports, and you know, where the, you know, and we can fight anyone from any sport, and you know, all that, and you know, he cut the promo in English too. The people didn't hate it, but they didn't like it either. And it just kind of felt. I know that, you know, when you do the Tokyo Dome, you need certain things. You need something out of the box for the Tokyo Dome, and you need something to capture the imagination of the public. You can't just do one of these shows with all the loaded match, you know, loaded lineup show, because they do that every month anyway. You know, you got to have something special. I just don't know that. It wouldn't have been my idea to bring unknown, you know, like the Gracie thing. You know, the Gracies were huge in Japan in, you know, 12 years ago. But, you know, to bring in, again, if it was Hoist Gracie or Hickson Gracie or Henzo Gracie. Yeah, I mean, I still wouldn't be thrilled about it, but it's like, it's just kind of like two unknown Gracie brothers that weren't even, neither of them were even big MMA stars or anything. And just
actually, like, Daniel is not even technically a Gracie. He's a cousin. He took the Gracie name.
Really?
So.
Yeah, wasn't Daniel,
Simos.
I forgot.
Samoas?
Samoas, yeah. Daniel Samoas. Because I think Daniel Samoa, I think that he fought Shinsuke Nakamura in a Ballytudo match years and years ago.
Yes, he did, and he beat him.
Yeah, he beat him, but Shinsuke Nakamura did a really good job in that match, because that match actually was, the Shinsuke Nakamura-Daniel Gracie match was the match that set up Shinsuke Nakamura for his 23-year-old IWGP title run, and his actual big push came because he was very competitive against a Gracie in an MMA fight. So yeah, that was the deal there. So that we had that match. Then it was Naito and Yujiro Takahashi, and the thing, you know, it was kind of sad. The match was excellent as far as if the working of the match was an excellent match. I was very excited watching it. Unfortunately, the crowd was really not, I mean, it just was, they weren't that much with Naito, and, you know, it's like he's, you know, he's in the main event of Tokyo Dome, and he's been getting the big push coming off of G1, and it just, he was just flat, as far as with the crowd. His work was excellent. Yujiro was cool. I'm getting the, you know, he's not great, but when he works with Naito, he is, because they, you know, they're former tag team partners, they've got that chemistry, and I get a kick out of Naito with the girls. You know, he had the two strippers with him, and you know, he plays with the, you know, plays that off real well. He does that pimp gimmick. That's, you know, it's good, because again, you know, when we don't have a lot of guys doing different gimmicks, and you got a guy, you know, doing the Ric Flair thing, it works. So you know, of course, Naito won the match with the Stardust Press, and then he did the Puma Blanca or whatever that wacky Lucha Libre submission move is that he's been using. And the idea was to get that submission move over, which, you know, so he's got a big, you know, new weapon in the Tokyo Dome match. I mean, like I was watching it, and again, like, I was just like, this match is really good, but there was something lacking. Then Nakamura and Shinsuke Nakamura and Naomi Chimura Fuji, this match was excellent. Nakamura so over. And Mara Fuji, you know, was the outsider, and, you know, he played his role well. Long match, back and forth. The two Bamayes, Nakamura got the win. I almost would have wished that they would have done something to not beat Mara Fuji this early in his, you know, basically his first New Japan match. But they, you know, it wasn't a long-term program direction. And then afterwards, Minoru Suzuki came out to challenge Nakamura for the next pay-per-view, so that should be a fun match, maybe even an excellent match. And the deal with Nakamura and Mara Fuji is they kept crossing each other up. They would do their spots, and their guy would always be out, you know, like move out of the way and things like that. So this is really a fun match to watch. It was really just a great, great match. And then the main event was, you know, 37 minutes of just a fantastic, you know, just like I said, match of the year. So much to it. Tanahashi did the, you know, that spot that Fit Finley likes to do, the fake knee injury spot. Brett used to do it a lot. He did it. You know, did a leapfrog, landed on his feet, went down hard, started selling the knee. I mean, he did it for so long. I mean, you could tell, and then he gets up and, you know, basically jumps Okada, and the crowd hated that. And it was interesting because the crowd here was a crowd, they were into the match. They didn't have a favorite in the sense of whoever was selling became the crowd favorite. I mean, and it wasn't like it was 50-50. It wasn't like, let's go, blah, blah, you know, like they would do here. This was a crowd where everybody at certain points, like when Tanahashi did the fake knee injury, the whole crowd turned on him and went with Okada. When Tanahashi was selling, the crowd just got completely behind Tanahashi. Later, when Okada was selling, they got completely behind him. Tanahashi worked on the right arm, the Rainmaker arm of Okada. Tremendous work. He did dragon screws, but instead of with a leg, with the arm. He did this thing where he would go back and forth. He would get the guy's the right arm, and he would do the bolo forearm, you know, that Cesaro does. And then he would do the elbow, you know, like the MMA elbow type of thing on the arm. And he would alternate with the bolo forearm and the elbow over and over and over on working the arm. Just worked it over like crazy. And then finally Okada hit the Rainmaker. And every time Okada hits the Rainmaker, it's over. But he hurt himself so bad that he could not do the cover. And when he finally did the cover, Tanahashi did kick out. It was interesting because it took so long that people did not believe that Tanahashi was going to lose in that spot, because the pop for the kick out was not as big as it should have been, in a sense. But, you know, they did, and then they came back and did all kinds of near falls. At one point in the match, Okada did a draping DDT on the floor off of the guardrail. It was on the mats, but still, it's on the floor. Tanahashi, like, hurt his neck. Tanahashi's selling was just incredible. Later, they finally got, they were doing all kinds of stuff. There were headbutt spots, you know, pump handle spots. Tanahashi did the ghetto clutch on Okada right in front of Ghetto, and Ghetto was going crazy. He was furious at this guy pilfering his finishing move on his protege right in front of him. They did a spot where, so Okada finally does the Rainmaker. Tanahashi's selling it like he's out cold, you know, but he did kick out. Then the next big spot was Tanahashi did the crossbody off the top, and then he went to the top to do the high fly flow, and Okada rolled out of the ring. So Tanahashi does this, the planche that he does in every match, although this was better than usual. He flew way across, I would say a good two-thirds to three-quarters of the way across the ring, onto the floor, you know, on the floor, but, you know, like, you know, onto Okada. And they're fighting outside the ring, and Okada gives him a tombstone pile driver on the floor, and they tease that both guys are done, you know, like Okada's done. Okada crawls in at 17. Tanahashi is out cold from that tombstone. I mean, even at the count of 18. And somehow, you know, he gets up, and he's in at 19 and a half. And, I mean, you really did think that this was not – the crowd was going crazy, because they really did believe – they believed this was going to be the count-out finish and all that. Then they did a double knockout finish. Okada got up around 7 or 8. Tanahashi again at 9.5 because of, and just selling the neck, holding his neck. The crowd, they were going, they went back and forth. Tanahashi back working on the arm. Okada did his drop kick to the front. He did the perfect drop kick to the back. Tanahashi does the, he ducks the Rainmaker, and hits, Tanahashi hits Okada with a Rainmaker, and Okada kicks out, and the place went nuts for that. Tanahashi goes up, high fly flow to the back, then goes up for the second one, the high fly flow, Okada gets the knees up, then they did a million reversals as Okada, I think he went for four Rainmakers, and Tanahashi ducked all four, and then he hit the fifth one. Well, he hit a tombstone pile driver. Again, another one by Okada. And then a couple more ducked Rainmakers. Finally hit the Rainmaker, 1, 2, 3 in the middle. And just great stuff. The one thing that they did, originally they had announced it was going to be the Universal title, which is the CMLL belt that Tanahashi won a couple weeks ago, versus the IWGP. And they dropped that, you know, Tanahashi did not come out with the Universal belt, which he did come out to on the last show. No mention of it at all. So when they did that, that's when I kind of figured that they may have had a change of plans on what they were doing. And,
didn't you predict that, Okada was going to win, and you were told you didn't understand business?
Yeah, but I think they, you know, then they did, you know. The whole thing with the belt versus belt and everything, the stipulation, I mean, that they went in with is that Tanahashi cannot challenge as long as Okada's champion, which is really no big deal. I guess that may mean that Naito is winning, Then, you know, Tanahashi and Naito, you know, they can probably go on a big show next year at some point. But it was just a freaking super, super match, super finish, clear, clean pin. There was no, slip on a banana peel. I mean, there was a winner and a loser. I mean, Tanahashi lost. It was a great win for Okada in the sense that, you know, they were 2-2. They had one draw. And everybody, I think that, you know, the whole thing was kind of set up to where, you know, this is like the big one. This is the last one of the series for now. And Okada, you know, it was not portrayed as a fluke. I mean, he beat the top guy in the company. And there you go. But so anyway, yeah, I go out of my way to see this one. This match was just it's the best series that I've seen since Misawa and Kobashi. I mean, just one of the best series of matches. It's better than Flair and Steamboat. When I look back now, I'm trying to think who else. Briscoe and Funk. I think it's better than Briscoe and Funk too. I won't say it was not better than Misawa and Kobashi. I wouldn't go that far, but it's up there with the best series of matches that I've ever seen.
All right, before we go, yesterday was the anniversary of the car accident in which Magnum TA crashed his Porsche. I guess tell us a little bit about his career, and people always ask the question, had this not occurred, what happened with Magnum TA?
Yeah, I mean, he was being groomed to be the top guy. You know, Dusty was grooming him to be the top guy. He was going to win the world title from Ric Flair at some point. He was very good. He was not great. He was very good. If he had been made, you know, like in the Carolinas territory, he was very strong. But I went to a lot of their shows, and when he would be out of Carolinas territory, and I mean the same thing when I would see him in Mid-South. I mean he. Because he had a little bit of size, you know, he had a good physique and kind of like that Tom Selleck look, which I think was really the thing that, like, you know, the promoters really wanted to push him as a big ladies man and everything. And again, you know, good worker, but he was, he in Mid-South, and I went to the matches there a lot. He was not as over as his push in the sense he was pushed really, really hard, well ahead of Terry Taylor. But Terry Taylor was actually the one that was the more over of the two. And then he went to Crockett. And, you know, I mean, they did the thing. They did, you know, basically the Goldberg thing. You know, he won every match in 90 seconds or less. That was the big thing. He always won with a belly-to-belly suplex first move. And, you know, you do that, and you push a guy like that. And he could cut a good promo. Look good and everything like that. You're going to get a guy over. And he was over. And, you know, he worked with Flair, and they, you know, they had great matches. That's when Rick had great matches with everybody. I saw a lot of it's like he did not have as much charisma as Sting. He was more, he was a better wrestler than Sting, but he was not going to be the answer. You know, when he won the title from Flair, it was not, you know, you never know, but I mean, people go like he was going to be Hulk Hogan and things like that. You know, I saw Hulk Hogan, you know, and it's like Hulk Hogan was something completely different, you know, than anyone. You know, I mean, it's you know, or The Rock. I mean, this guy was not at that level. He was not, you know, it did not change the course of history, the fact that he got in that wreck, and, you know, like maybe they would have whatever. Maybe they wouldn't have lost the war, so to speak. It was going to go the way it was going to go, either way. That said, you know, it was a terrible tragedy. He was coming back from Bennigan's, where all the wrestlers used to hang out, Bennigan's and Charlotte, after their shows, and crashed into a telephone pole, I believe. And the car was, I remember seeing the picture, the car was split in two. The one thing about that incident is, It did exemplify how over wrestling was, and how over he was as far as Charlotte and in the Carolinas. There was so much interest, you know, when that story of that crash came. You know, it was one of those things where it got some press. It was covered, but it wasn't. It was covered like, you know, this TV wrestler was in a crash, and, you know, he was in critical condition. He could have died, easily could have died. you know, he severed his spine, basically. I mean, there was the talk and everything that he would come back and wrestle. But, I mean, I remember when, talking to some of the guys, and it's like, look, you sever your spine. You know, he was never going to wrestle again, and he never did. I mean, he was never supposed to walk again, and, I mean, he was never supposed to get out of that wheelchair. That's the reality. And he was lucky to live. And, I mean, he got out of that wheelchair, and, I mean, God bless him. You know, the guy lived a productive life in business, in family. He's an inspiration. You know, he really is. I got all the respect in the world for what that guy did. He didn't go out there and feel sorry for himself and go, oh, my God, I could have been world champion and they, you know, this thing and go into depression. I mean, I'm sure he did go into depression. You can't not. But the fact is he picked himself up. He somehow, you know, I remember when he was at whatever it was at the Crockett Cup in Baltimore, and he walked down the aisle. And this guy was never supposed to walk. And that when he walked down the aisle at the Crockett Cup, this was not, I don't believe that this was advertised in the sense that I think that they knew he was going to be there. I think that Dusty did say he hadn't been in front of anyone. He hadn't been in front of the fans since the accident. And I'm pretty sure that they said that he was going to be there. In fact, I'm sure of it because I remember that they were just shy of a sellout. And my thought was, my God, Magnum TA, I was at the show. I thought, Magnum TA is going to be here live. And how is this not sold out? And I mean, it was you know, right under. It was probably 12,000 people in a 13,000 seat place and everything. But he came out. And that was one of the biggest pops that I ever heard in a wrestling show was when he walked. Oh, my God. So that was pretty good. And, you know, he spent years as an announcer for a WCW, you know, worked backstage in a variety of roles, got into the communications business, things like that. So, you know, still around. He's on the Crockett documentary, one of the best guys on that documentary. I thought when he spoke, I thought he was the, you know, a lot of those guys were, I don't know how to say fantasy, but I just thought that like when they talked about like what was going on and their perspectives were just like, whether it was romanticized or skewed or whatever, I was thinking, you know, I would watch these guys and see what they'd say and I go like, look, it's not going to be like that. You're wrong. And Magnum was out there and everything that Magnum said was spot on about the times, about what was going to happen. You know, just he understood the business. You know, he was Dusty's big protege. He was the guy that, you know, Dusty was going to pass the torch to. And, you know, I mean, he would have been, as long as that promotion was around, I think that he probably, well, you know, I don't know. You know, the one thing is like, Dusty fell out of favor. And perhaps if he was around and Dusty wasn't pushing himself, I mean, like, it's not like that Crockett Promotions was going to survive and Turner wasn't going to buy it and all that. That all would have happened whether he was there or not. Now, as far as his career goes, you know, I can speculate what would happen. I mean, when Dusty fell out of favor, if he was there, would maybe Dusty not have fallen out of favor at that point? But Dusty was still, you know, I don't know. Dusty's booking was still going to be what it was. And he still, you know, they were still going to have the fights when Turner got it because they would want results and everything. I always thought that when Dusty was gone, that Magnum would have left with him and gone to WWF and that Magnum would have flopped in WWF just because, you know, I just thought that that's what happened because it was the same as essentially with Barry, the same thing that happened with Barry Windham. You know, Barry Windham was, you know, actually a better wrestler than Magnum, not quite as charismatic as Magnum, but better in the ring. And Barry didn't, you know, for whatever reason, Barry never made it in WWF after those, you know, after that run in WCW, where he was the best worker in the business practically. That's the deal. I was thinking about that today, and I think that the guys, it's a tremendous inspirational story. He not that he came back or anything like that, but that he went and he lived a life, has a family. You know, he married Courtney, who was Tully Blanchard's wife, and he actually raised Tully Blanchard's kids. You know, and of course, Magnum and Tully Blanchard was one of the most famous matches in the history of Jim Crockett Promotions at the it was the second Starcade, the I Quit match, maybe the third. That was quite the, you know, interesting, you know, story of those two. And, you know, I, from all I understand, he did a great job raising those kids. So, you know, great, you know, more power to him.
All right, everybody, we're going to wrap it up. Earlier today, we had another show with Frank Shamrock talking the special that is available right now at Spike.com. It aired on Spike TV last week, so head up there and check that out. We got a new show tomorrow. Chris Daniels is going to be on the show talking Bound for Glory. That should be a lot of fun. And new observers, figure fours, back issues, all sorts of stuff coming up. So check out the front page for more, and we'll talk to you again after a while.